Chapter 9. Doing a cooking show or making a documentary about food for television requires very particular talents, energies, and skill sets, which I have been learning slowly over many years. Making a fictional narrative film in which food is the center is another kettle of fish completely, and it was doing so, at times clumsily, that altered my life significantly. I began writing what would eventually become the film Big Night over 30 years ago. I had always wanted to write a script that would be more in keeping with the tone and structure of a quote-unquote foreign film. By this I mean a film that was primarily character-driven, eschewed stereotypes, and ended somewhat ambiguously. When I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan during the 1980s, I was often unemployed for lengthy periods of time. In order to maintain sanity instead of sitting at home and waiting for the phone to ring, I would exercise, visit museums, attend the theater, affordable standing room tickets only, or go to the cinema. Unlike today, there were many independently owned cinemas that showed foreign and independent films. One afternoon, in a little cinema on 68th Street and Broadway, which is sadly no longer there, after completing my daily workout, I ate an inexpensive, very unhealthy meal of something or other at the adjacent coffee shop, also no longer there, grabbed a cup of Joe to go, paid my few dollars, and sat in a half-empty theater to watch the glorious Babette's Feast. If you haven't seen the film, I can only suggest that you do, especially if you're a foodie. Not to spoil it, but to this day, I vividly remember hearing the audience moan with never-to-be-realized pleasure as each dish was served in the climactic dinner scene. There is no doubt that the sounds that emanated from the cinema during Babette's Feast were echoed only in cinemas in the Times Square area that showed films of a very different ilk, or so I have been told. At any rate, the subtle brilliance of the film and the communal experience of enjoying it stayed with me for many years afterward and eventually became something of an inspiration for Big Night. Any number of experiences can inspire or influence what anyone creates, but perhaps the primary inspiration for Big Night was an Italian restaurant in Miami that I had been to while filming early in my career that was owned by two immigrant brothers, one of whom would often sing as he served you. Although I cannot remember the brothers' names or the name of the restaurant, I remember them as very charming raconteurs, and the food they made was delicious. During the same trip, I also happened to meet a Corsican by the name of Pascal, who affected the air of a wannabe mafioso and owned another very successful Italian restaurant. This handsome, blue-eyed, foul-mouthed restaurateur became the template for the character of Pascal played so perfectly in Big Night by Ian Holm. The brothers of the aforementioned eatery were the genesis of the characters Primo and Secondo, played by Tony Shalhoub and myself. But there was one experience that I had as a very young man that is the reason the film is set in a restaurant at all. Between my sophomore and junior years of college, it was my dream to work and live in Manhattan. Luckily, through familial generosity and good old nepotism, I was able to secure a position in a midtown restaurant called Alfredo's, the original of Rome. My uncle Frank, my dad's brother, had designed the interior of Alfredo's and convinced the manager to give me a job, while my aunt Dora, my dad's sister, and her husband Bob were kind enough to house me in their spare bedroom in their beautiful East Side apartment. I could not have been more fortunate or happier, so at age 19, I started to work at Alfredo's as a busboy. But because I spoke English, or because I was a terrible busboy, or both, I was promoted to barboy almost straight away. Alfredo's did a huge lunch business, mostly for businessmen who worked in the area or tourists who wanted a taste of authentic Italian food. I say authentic because Alfredo's was a sister restaurant to the Alfredo's in Rome. The signature dish was, as you may have guessed, fettuccine Alfredo. This now ubiquitous dish was created in 1907 by Alfredo Di Lelio. It is basically fettuccine with butter and parmigiano. Not basically, it is actually just that. But somehow, Alfredo's version, with a bit more butter and parmigiano, as well as the spectacle of preparing it tableside, the long strands of fettuccine glistening with the fats of the butter and cheese, turned it and him into a worldwide sensation. Sometime in the late 1970s, whoever owned the name saw an opportunity to open in New York, and the establishment is still in existence today, making their eponymous dish according to the original recipe. However, over the years, in many restaurants, the sublimely simple combination of butter and cheese has been altered to satisfy American palates. Cream has crept its way in, unnecessary, as well as chicken, yuck, broccoli, why, and turkey. Really? Fuck off. At any rate, fettuccine Alfredo was basically all I ate for the entire summer, and as a college student, I thought it was just dandy. Like most bartenders and most restaurants, at Alfredo's, one not only made the drinks, but poured the wine and made espresso and cappuccino. For about 3 hours, it was a nonstop frenzy of dispensing liquids from one vessel into another, as well as restocking the glasses, ice, fruit, garnishes, coffee beans, milk, etc. And I absolutely loved it. I not only find cleaning and organizing satisfying and relaxing, but they allow me time to ruminate on such questions as how I might approach a certain role or whether anyone will ever hire me again. I was therefore in OCD heaven, scouring a bar, organizing a stockroom, and getting paid for it to boot. Two different chain-smoking bartenders trained me. The first was a very fast-talking Albanian who, like many of his countrymen, also spoke Italian. The other was an American ex-Marine, ex-mercenary soldier, and ex-convict who had spent time in prison for murder. I think he was eventually released because his crime was deemed self-defense or something like that. But he did actually kill someone either way, which, at the time, I thought was terrifyingly cool. Needless to say, I was very careful not to anger him. So the murderous mercenary and the silver-tongued Albanian took me under their nicotine-stained wings and patiently taught me how to become a very fluid, efficient bartender, a skill I hope to regain. And to this day, I am forever in their debt. Like many restaurants, Alfredo's was a whirlwind of energy emanating from a cultural patchwork of employees. I must say, coming from the rather white suburbs of Westchester, it was a breath of fresh air to be a part of a place where the ethnic diversity of the staff rivaled that of the United Nations. Except for a couple of native New Yorkers whose heritage I never came to know, the waiters were Greek, Egyptian, Italian, Albanian, Spanish, and Eastern European, while most of the kitchen and bus staff were either Puerto Rican or Dominican, including the busboy Cristiano, whose name and parts of his personality were used for the waiter-slash-busboy character in Big Night, played by the too-talented Mark Anthony. As a young actor, I reveled in the variety of accents and the accidental poetry that occurred when one person had to translate what they were thinking in one language in order to express it in another. I was also particularly fascinated by how a restaurant's structure mirrored that of the theater. The kitchen was backstage, which, during a lunch or dinner rush, was its own mad biosphere filled with frantic humans barely controlling flames and blades. Simultaneously, the dining room was onstage, where some of the same humans, after walking through a swinging door, instantaneously became cool, calm, and collected, almost to the point of being benign. I have only ever witnessed this schizophrenic behavior, and of course exhibited it myself, while performing in the theater. It is as fascinating as it is disturbing, but in these venues, it is not only normal, but necessary. Many years later, when I was finally able to make a living solely by acting and no longer needed to work in restaurants or paint apartments to survive, I began to mull over these experiences and decided to put them down in a form that vaguely resembled a screenplay. After a few years of getting nowhere fast, I asked my first cousin and one of my best friends, Joseph Tropiano, who loves cinema as much as I, to partner up. Over a period of the next 5 years or so, we eventually ended up with something that we were happy with. It was a screenplay that dramatized the struggle between commerce and art, portrayed the Italian immigrant as someone unconnected with the mafia, a very unusual depiction in American cinema, showed the importance of food in Italian culture and how it is often used to express emotions, and did not have a happy ending. Little did we know we were making something that would be so well received or would become a food film cult classic. If we had known any of that, we certainly would have negotiated a better back end. I first met Isabella Rossellini through the co-director of Big Night, Campbell Scott. Isabella had committed to doing the film while we shopped the script around to every producer in Christendom. I mentioned to Isabella that I would like to spend some time observing a chef at work, and she introduced me to Pino Luongo, a restaurateur in New York City. After explaining what I was looking for, Pino suggested I go to Le Madri, unfortunately now defunct, one of his restaurants on 17th and 7th Avenue, where Johnny Scapin was the head chef. Johnny Scapin comes from the tiny village of Mason Vicentino in the Veneto region of northern Italy, where his family owned a small restaurant. After a brief stint in seminary school as a young boy, Johnny realized he was not destined for the priesthood, and at the age of 14, he began a four-year course at the Recoraro Terme Culinary Institute, which expanded his knowledge of Italian regional dishes. At the age of 18, he moved to England and honed classic cooking skills in the French-influenced kitchen of the Dorset Hotel in Bournemouth. After a two-year obligatory stint in the Italian Army in an alpine skiing regiment, where he also cooked for his commanding officers, enlist me now, he worked at the famed Hotel Excelsior on the Lido in Venice. In the early 1980s, he became the head chef at the very successful Castellano in New York for a few years, until moving to New York's Bice, where he trained the late, great Anthony Bourdain, and finally to Le Madre. He eventually stepped away from the kitchen to oversee Pino Longo's five New York restaurants. He left the city in 2000 to open his own restaurants in upstate New York and taught at the Colavita Center for Italian Food and Wine at the CIA. That's the Culinary Institute of America, not the governmental spy organization. Gianni could not have been more welcoming, and even though I had the option of visiting some of Pino's other kitchens, after meeting Gianni, I never left Le Madre. Over the next couple of years, as we searched for funding for the film, whenever I wasn't working, I would spend time in Johnny's kitchen, learning everything I could from the staff and picking Johnny's brain. One of the things I asked Johnny to teach me was how to make a frittata, because at the end of the film, my character, Secondo, makes a frittata, which he shares with his brother, Primo, and the busboy, waiter, Cristiano. Our rather bold plan was to shoot the scene in one continuous take with no coverage. This meant that there would be no possibility of editing it down, and therefore every element would have to work perfectly, so I needed to be very adept at making it. Also, with the exception of a couple of lines at the beginning, there is no dialogue, so it almost felt like a scene from a silent film. Shooting the scene in a single wide master shot meant that I would have to cook the frittata in real time. If something went wrong, I would have to cut, reset, and begin another take. We rehearsed a number of times to solidify the blocking of the actors and the basic timing of everything. During rehearsal, I was using a pan that I had chosen from the prop master. Like all the props, it was or resembled a pan of the period, late 1950s, which meant there was no hope of slipping in a Teflon-coated pan to make my job a little easier. Needless to say, the frittata kept sticking to the pan, and I started to panic. Because if it didn't work seamlessly, we would have to shoot coverage and end up editing the scene. Instinctively, we all felt this would compromise the emotional integrity of the scene and rob it of its tension. So I grabbed a large aluminum pan and gave that a try, and luckily, it worked perfectly every time. We ended up doing seven takes, two of which we had to abort partway for reasons I can't remember, but the other five were keepers, as they say. I don't know which take we finally chose to use, but the entire scene is a single shot that lasts about 5.5 minutes. I'm so glad we were able to successfully shoot it as one continuous wide shot from beginning to end, as I believe it's what makes the scene so compelling. I still make frittatas all the time, but they often end up sticking no matter what pan I use, and I kick myself for not slipping that perfect pan into my bag on the last day of filming. Here is a recipe for a frittata as taught to me by Gianni Scapin. Frittata. Serves 2. 5 or 6 large eggs. 3 to 4 tablespoons olive oil. Kosher salt. A good pinch of chopped fresh flat leaf parsley, optional. A good pinch of freshly grated Parmigiano Reggiano. Freshly ground black pepper. Crack the eggs into a bowl and beat them gently with a fork for a minute or so, making sure you angle the bowl so that you really blend them well. You could use a whisk instead of a fork, if you prefer, but you will end up with a puffier textured frittata. In a 10-inch sauté pan with sloping sides, heat the olive oil over medium heat. You want to get it pretty hot and tilt the pan to make sure the sides are well coated. When the oil is hot, season the eggs with salt and add the parsley, if using, then pour the mixture into the pan. Scramble the eggs vigorously with a silicone spatula, tipping and moving the pan continuously and drawing the eggs from the sides into the middle. Keep the pan moving to make sure the eggs don't stick. Add the Parmigiano and add a good grinding of pepper. Then flip or turn the frittata and cook for a minute or so more until golden and cooked through. Serve immediately. A couple of years later, the same company that produced Big Night brought me to Rome for about 5 weeks to act in a film. My only friend in Rome at the time, Claudia Della Fratina, was working for a producer in a small office not far from where I was staying, and we got together for lunch the day after I arrived. I walked to her office thinking we would take a stroll and grab a bite, but we were in a slightly more residential area of the city, and when I arrived, she said that she usually just ate in. I imagine she would have brought sandwiches, like many people the world over, but there was no lunchbox or takeaway bag on her desk. Instead, I saw a small kitchen at one end of the office, to which a moment later Claudia was headed. "I thought I might just cook for us," she said in her beautifully accented English. Let it be known that Claudia is very smart, very kind, and very pretty. She is half German, half Italian, with fair skin and large light blue eyes, and speaks English perfectly with a delicate Italian accent. She somehow eats pasta every day yet remains slender, is chic without spending absurd amounts on clothing, smokes hand-rolled cigarettes but never to excess, and loves to drink wine. Wisely, she no longer works in the film business. Instead, she designs hats and lives in Rome with her husband, a photographer who is even nicer than she is. In short, I want to be her, or him, or both of them. Anyway, in response to her offer to cook for us, I said, "Oh, don't go to any trouble." "It's no trouble. I make lunch most days anyway," she said. I first met Claudia during my first press junket for a Hollywood comedy that was great fun to make, but, like many I've done, was a bomb at the box office. I was sent to do press in Italy and Spain in advance of the film's foreign release. Claudia was working freelance then and had been assigned to look after Kate and me during our stay in Rome, and we have remained friends ever since. As we chatted about this and that, she filled a large pot with water and put it on the stove to boil. She then took two small zucchini and sliced them into thin rounds and a clove of garlic, which she cut in half lengthwise. Pouring a glug of very dark green extra virgin olive oil into a pan, she dropped in the garlic along with a few pepperoncini. After they had simmered for a few minutes, she removed them, placed two handfuls of spaghetti into the now boiling water, and began to sauté the zucchini. When the pasta was cooked, she strained it and mixed it together in the pan with some of the starchy pasta water. With the exception of my father's Friday night specialty, pasta con aglio e olio, this might have been the simplest dish of pasta I'd ever eaten. The deeply flavorsome olive oil coated the sweet zucchini, helping it cling to the pasta, while just a suggestion of garlic emerged as the pepperoncini gave subtle heat to it all. Following my family's tradition, I had never really cooked with extra virgin olive oil. We always used regular olive oil, oil from olives that had been through many pressings, making it lighter but much less tasty. Nor did we ever use pepperoncini, as neither of my parents cared for anything spicy. So this unassuming dish was a bit of a revelation for me. I know it sounds silly, but out of all of the meals I have eaten, it still remains one of my favorites. This is partly because it was cooked and shared with my dear friend Claudia, but also because it was the perfect balance of five simple ingredients. As I travel, research, and cook more over the years, I find this culinary equilibrium is realized with the most humble ingredients time and time again in the Italian kitchen, even in a very small one in the back of an office in Rome many years ago. A pause for a libation. The old-fashioned. Purportedly, this legendary libation was created in 1806 in upstate New York and is the first drink to be called a cocktail. Whiskey, bitters, sugar, water. That was basically it. By the middle part of that century, the cocktail eventually became more and more complex, with the addition of a variety of liquors like orange curacao, absinthe, and who knows what else. Drinkers looking for the simpler version would ask for it to be made the old-fashioned way, hence its now very famous moniker. I'm not a big bourbon drinker, but this cocktail is very hard not to want. Here's how to make it. 1 teaspoon simple syrup, a few dashes Angostura bitters, 2 shots rye or bourbon, ice, orange slice and cherry to garnish. Pour the simple syrup into an old-fashioned glass, meaning a rocks glass. Add the Angostura bitters. Add the booze. Add the ice. Stir. Add the garnish. You could also make this with scotch or Irish whiskey if you prefer. a great drink for any season or reason.